This is the Agile Thoughts Podcast, and I'm Lance Kine.
This is Will Iverson with ChangeNode. Go check it out, changenode.com. And I've got a website there where I'm helping folks in the tech industry think about jobs and careers and how to move all that forward. And the YouTube video also covers tech and especially job stuff.
This is a continuing episode of a series with Will Iverson about tech jobs and IT in the face of AI.
And I think to kind of pull it back to jobs and stuff, right? Here's my hypothesis, right? Is that what's going to happen is people are going to start thinking up like big projects they couldn't do before because it was too expensive and too hard and time consuming.
Yeah.
And that's the big bet. That's what nobody really knows is what kinds of bigger projects might people want to do? And then what would the AIs or the LLMs help them do? Right. Like, for example, like we both know that there's just a ton of COBOL apps sitting around, even still. In this day and age, how many times do you use a piece of software that still has a bug in it?
Right? I can't even think about it because I'm probably used to working around it now.
Oh yeah, totally. I think about like there was a time when I was excited about installing a new app on my phone.
Right.
And now I'm like, damn it. Yeah. I really don't want to. And especially because like, I'm going to call it out, like a lot of the banks and the insurance companies and stuff, they have just the jankiest, cheap, nasty little apps, right? And I'm like, okay, well, you know, if AI, like sort of this thing, like, well, if AI is so good, why do I still have bugs on my machine?
Yeah.
Like, what the heck's going on? What could I do? Like, if I just took it for default, I'm just using Claude right now for stuff mostly, but I'm able to tell Claude, generate a UI for me. And it just does. Boom. Mm-hmm. Right.
In some language or whatever. Did you specify some language or do you specify anything or just say generate a UI?
You know, it's really weird because like sometimes if I'm doing something and I know I'm going to want to monkey with it more, I'll specify Svelte, which is my preferred JavaScript framework because I'm a nerd and as opposed to React or whatever. But like, yeah, I might specify it. And that's part of where, depending on the project and how much I care, how much I know I'm going to have to look at the code, what have you. Honestly, you get really good results just by telling it to write raw JavaScript or TypeScript. You know, maybe you tell it to pull in. This is one of the things that's sort of weird where everything gets flips around because the quality, the output is often related to the age and the amount of existing code. Mm-hmm. So like, that's where I find that they do really well with SQL because SQL's been around since before either one of us was born, I think. Mm-hmm. And so there's so much SQL stuff out there that it tends to be pretty good. JavaScript, CSS, Svelte, you know, that's a, like Svelte 5, I think is less than 6 months old, maybe a year at most. And so there's not as many tutorials or samples and stuff. So it doesn't work as well. So we've kind of flipped it around where the older it is, the better it works with that stuff. But there is this idea where like you stop caring as much. Like I remember when people were really opinionated about compiler output. Right? Oh, well, you know, you handwrite some assembly for the stuff you really care about. That was like a big thing for years. And then at some point people are like, the compilers are bulletproof. You don't care. Right. So if I'm writing code right now with an AI or an LLM, I care about, you know, and I might have to fix it and tweak it and whatever. But at some point, like, it's just like the code becomes almost like that intermediate language that's just dropped onto disk. And some of this even goes back to the stuff from old school Agile about like, you know, well, is the code more important or is the test suite more important?
Right.
If I write tests, I mean, right out of the gate, I get way better results if I even tell it to write tests. Write the test, make sure the test passed. Treat those as requirements and keep them rolling.
Have you used Claude Code?
Claude Code, yeah. You install it in the command line, in the terminal, or the command prompt, or whatever you want to call it. Yeah, that's the main tool I'm using right now.
Oh, okay.
Because I can just work at the command line, and it does its thing. And
I'm using, and I haven't, like I said, tried the MCP capabilities yet, because I think it's a little bit slower than Claude Code is Juni on IntelliJ's platform. So they have an integrated AI that's more of like a ChatGPT that can easily and casually watch your code and give you feedback on it. And of course, there, again, their terms and conditions are that we won't look your data. But the most recently, they upgraded it to something called Junie. So Junie's the newer name, and that's MCP capable. And so I'm looking forward to seeing what it can do.
I think that's an example of like the gap that we're getting right now. I remember when we were first talking about test automation, and at Solutions IQ, I'd kind of keeping an eye on all these different teams, right? And I'd go talk to one team, and they would be in this like big debate about whether or not we should use JUnit or TestNG. People would be like practically fist fights over it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, is this TDD, or are we going to try to do a BDD model or whatever, right?
Right.
And if I sat at a table and I heard some devs talking like that, I knew that they were probably going to be fine. You know, it's the same way, like if your kids are arguing with you about whether or not spinach or broccoli is better. Like, you're like, dude, I'm still winning, you know, like, that's great. You know,
right.
If the big problem is which test framework we're using, then their heads are in the right place. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the things that I noticed today when people are talking is I will talk to some friends and they will be like, well, is ChatGPT better or Claude or Cursor or Windsurf or, you know, IntelliJ's plugin or VS Code stuff? Or do I use Klein or do I use this or whatever? And it's like, yeah. And then like people like they're nerding out on it. And then like, do they even have the time or the hassle? And then at the other end, you know, I'll have people who are like, they don't know whether or not it's a server or a client-based AI. Right.
You were talking about that email conversation earlier. I'm like, who are you thinking about when you were talking about this? Right.
Yeah, yeah. And so I have the same thing with devs, where I literally will talk to some devs and they'll be like, yeah, I tried it. And, you know, a common one is they'll say like, well, I tried it a year ago and it sucked. And yeah, I'm busy at work and I don't care, kind of thing, you know? And it's hard because I think a lot of those folks think of themselves as being pretty technically savvy and they're hip, they're cool, they're on it.
You know the design patterns probably. This is a new factor in the who you're trying to decide the psychology of a developer is like, oh, they know all the design patterns, but they hate AI because whatever experience they had or most recently had, it just couldn't reach their bar.
Yeah. And I'm sympathetic. I mean, I messed around with CSS like in 2001 to 2003, and it was terrible. And so I got this really bad impression of CSS back then, and it took me years to come back around and be like, oh, this is actually pretty awesome now. But it took a lot, took years, because you get into it too early. The economics around, like right now it's AI and then on the computer, and you know, obviously it's natural language getting the software to do things and what have you. The big one over the next couple of years is going to be the robots. They're working on that stuff super hard right now, and the technical impact and then the jobs impact. So this is the thing I want to talk about for just a second, which mm-hmm. is this thing called the dystopian gap.
Okay, let's hear it.
So right now, today, there's one version of events, which is there's only this like kind of bread box of stuff that we need to survive. Like, you've seen Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I'm sure, you know, this notion of like, well, you need clothing and shelter and food and entertainment. Like, you just need this kind of basket of stuff to have a decent life, healthcare, right? Mm-hmm. So let's just say for the sake of discussion that you get to where you don't need to keep adding jobs and stuff to build all those things out. Right. Mm. Or you get to where it's kind of deflationary and that you just need less and less money and time and to do all that stuff. Right. And the quality of the jobs. One example of that might be, well, I might need to hire a 180K a year developer in the past because they need all these skills. But, you know, if mostly what they're doing is, you know, be functionally equivalent to prompt engineering, maybe I can get by with a $90,000 developer.
Yeah.
Maybe I can go from having a team of five 180K developers to four 90Ks and one 180K or even 220K, like senior dev, who's like the troubleshooter guy, you know? The dystopian gap is this idea that you have large chunks of our economics where people start having to go down the food chain in terms of their economics. Like, one way to put that in concrete is, let's say that there used to be 1 million developers And now you only need 500,000 developers, right. And they're more productive than the million were. Mm. And so what are those other 500,000 going to do? And then it's like, you know, the dystopian version is, well, they become pizza runners or something.
Pound sand, yes.
Pound sand, you know, like... And I think there's a little whiff of this with some of the data I've seen about like the 30-year-olds. Like, so they say that something like 50% of the 21 to 30-year-olds live at home still.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's a lot higher than a lot of folks think. And I think that part of that is, let's say you're 25 and, you know, you maybe you have your job, you know, the cliche one would be social media marketing person or something, right?
Okay.
And then you get fired, right? You don't have a job anymore. So what are you going to do? You could bleed out all your money that you, if you've managed to save any or what have you, or you go moving back in with mom and dad.
Right, right, right.
And I kind of like to think that maybe people get along better with their parents. You know? Like, I mean, just generically speaking, I'd like to think that as a class, like what's the point of all this time and energy that we put in relationship development and sure. all these things?
Sure.
So it's not that big of a hardship, but from an economic standpoint, it's a symptom of this erosion of valuable jobs. And I'm sure that there's a book called BS Jobs that came out.
No, I don't know that. Okay.
Oh, yeah. There's this book, you know, I don't know what the rating is for this podcast, but look, it's BS Jobs, right?
Okay.
And basically it was this guy who was going in and he was looking at how many of the jobs in corporate America didn't actually serve any real function.
Oh.
Right. And he was also, and part of it was there's an economic component. There's also, frankly, like a little bit of an identity problem, like as in, let's say I get paid a decent job to go in and do a job that I don't care about and that kind of nobody cares about. Like there's a slightly soul crushing aspect to that.
Right.
And so if you go through and you start chopping away at between BS jobs, all these other things, the reason I call it the dystopian gap is because there is a point where I think if enough people can't work and pay their bills, it starts to become a real economic and political problem, right? Like if you get to where unemployment hits 20% or more specifically, and this is one of the problems, is that you might have a really low unemployment number, but that's because there's so many people that need people that are like the lower end of the spectrum for jobs.
Okay. Right?
Yeah. Like as in, well, yeah, there's plenty of jobs.
Right.
Like, there's plenty of low like paid jobs.
Mowing lawns, blowing weeds, raking.
Yep. Working the line at the retail food, fast food joint.
Picking apples.
Picking apples, right?
Grapes of Wrath reference.
But some of that stuff's getting automated too.
Yes.
Like there are robots that, because like when you're a farmer and you want to pick your plants, it is actually easier to just get a machine that you can just run through the field for a day than to try to deal with bringing on a bunch of workers to deal with that. Right? Yeah,
that machine might cost a couple million dollars and you maybe rent one for $200,000. So you have to do some computation in ROI because that machine isn't going to be free. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what agriculture has been doing for 100 years, you know, is just cost optimization, working it out. Right.
Yeah.
So the dystopian gap is this problem where you can keep eroding away at worker leverage. We'll just go with that as the terminology, right? Like, and we're seeing some of that play out right now with return to office. Mm. Like a couple of years ago, you know, developers were in demand, low unemployment. So it's like, yeah, I'm happy to work, but I'm not driving in. And especially like in a lot of places where it's like, well, yeah, if your commute's 35 to an hour, and then you get into some interesting cost of living, load balancing,
right.
Like, hey, I moved to a more rural area that was less expensive,
right.
And you hope to capture, if I can get a Bay Area salary and live in a really inexpensive location,
absolutely. Rad.
But if I am living in a really low cost area, but I can't get work at all.
Right. Because of return to office, for example, would be a component.
And it that's part of the leverage.
Filters it down a bit.
Yeah. So I see a lot of data points that are consistent with this kind of dystopian gap question. And the problem is, what do you do about it? And how long does it take? Because like to a certain extent, like if you're the parent, like if you're the parent and your 25-year-old or your 28-year-old comes home, mm-hmm. right? And especially if the parent's not connected to the economy, then they're going to be like, well, go get a job. And if the kid's just like, well, I can't get a job, go get a job, can't get a job, right? What do you do? So apparently in China, they call that there's like these kids, they, yeah. they're like the lie down kids.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
So is that the future? And if so, what does that look like? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Let me do sidebar a little bit on the lie down kids. As someone who lived in China for a while. Mm-hmm. The lie down kids is a movement where recently there's a dissatisfaction with the economy and how hard it is to get a job for the younger people for sure. And I think we see the same thing. I'm seeing the same thing as someone who lives near a major metropolitan area near Houston, that a lot of the people who are out of work are junior level or just out of college level. So it's hard. It's harder, even more so, to get a job if you're junior at something. And so what in China, what they've done is they just like, he says, screw it. I'm going to tell my mom, I'm going to lay on the couch. That's going to be my job. I'm going to lay on the couch and play video games. And, or they go to the street and they lie down on the street somewhere by the place they got laid off from. And then a bunch of other people join them. So the Communist Party doesn't like any of that. And because it makes good pictures on social media, which can stir up trouble for the single party. But so that's the lie down.
Well, one version of it I heard was that part of the challenge was for a lot of the kids is that they were like, well, I'm just going to take care of my folks. And so they sort of, their job became the 5 to 15 hour a week. You know, I pick up groceries, I do this, I do some oddball chores. So I kind of help around the home.
Yeah.
One of the challenges was there is, like, you can only tell a kid to go back to school so many times, right? Have you heard the term Dutch disease?
No.
So
but it takes money to go to school. So I'm not quite sure. I'm curious where your head with that. So anyways.
Well, okay. So basically the first real stock markets evolved in the Netherlands, right? And it kind of was rooted in things like, well, we're going to send out all these ships. If only a certain percentage of them make them back, you don't want to have one merchant put all their investment in one ship. And so someone worked out the idea that, well, what if we send out 100 ships and 100 merchants all chip in and we all share, right? So it's a risk management thing. And it was also a way to do it funding. And so then they're literally like, well, we're going to issue stock in the ships. So it's like, did my ship come in? Mm-hmm. Literally goes back to that hundreds of years, right? Mm-hmm. And so the thing was, is that they kind of worked out an awesome system for managing it.
Yeah.
And then individuals in the Netherlands would literally be like, well, you know, let's say that you were sort of like the functional equivalent of like, you know, a low end merchant, right? But you put some money into one of these ship comes in and next thing you know, you're very wealthy. So you get all these problems that you would have with any time in an economy when you suddenly have a lot of wealth dropping into the system, especially if it's hitting all those folks where like nobody wants to work at the functional equivalent of the local restaurant because it's too expensive to live, right? And if you work at the restaurant, you're better off moving into, you know, becoming a stock trader. Right.
Okay.
So do you know anybody? Can you get in? Do you have a little insider tip? Like all these things that we sort of think of as components of that start evolving even back then. And so Dutch disease refers to this idea that you basically, your country winds up not doing anything but financial services. Because everything else is just dumb. Because like in comparison, right? Like if I could guarantee you that you put $1,000 into the stock market and you're going to make 10 grand in a year.
Yeah.
Like the only thing you're going to do is scrape up every penny you can and possibly take out huge amounts of debt to be able to put your money in to multiply it. So now imagine if everybody you know is doing that. What does that do to the economy?
Inflates the stock prices. If we're talking about stock, for example, it creates a bubble there, and the price of labor goes up. I suppose and you can't eat out for a very low cost.
So maybe you might deal with that by bringing in people from another country.
Oh, no, Will, that's bad. There's a nice man in the White House who told me that's bad, bad, bad.
Right?
In fact, it's even bad as to outsource your work to other countries.
Mm-hmm. And then maybe it also inflates your prices of land. Right? So, like, why is it so expensive to live in New York or San Francisco? And because of all the salaries that are all dropping out from the money, right? So mm-hmm. the Dutch disease idea is that you get a couple of these very specific things. You get tons of money, you get financialization where debts and moving money around and access to money are a huge deal. But part of it is you see your manufacturing sector and even your food kind of collapse. Because the services and the financials just eat everything else, right?
Okay.
And so in the US, we actually kind of embarked on that as part of globalization, especially starting in the 70s. We kind of said, look, it's really cheap, the resources from everywhere else, and we're going to export our manufacturing to cheaper places. It'll make everything cheap, right? And then all the financialization stuff kind of kicks in. And we've got wave after that, like, the 80s, Gordon Gekko and Greed is Good, you know, the 90s stock market. And then even now today, like if you pull up a stock market chart for market cap, you see just so much concentration in those tech companies, right? So one question is basically like, what happens to all of these things if the tech market and the tech labor market start to shrink pretty dramatically? Like, do the prices of housing collapse in some of these areas? Does that have other knock-on effects? At what point does the stock market wind up looking like, and there's a really weird version of this, where the big tech companies keep investing in this sort of circular loop in the AI tech? Like, imagine Google or Apple or Microsoft or any of these guys, if they were able to generate all the revenue that they generate right now with 20% of the staff.
Oh.
Right? So they become insanely profitable, right? Their profit per employee goes through the roof, right?
I'm listening. So trying to that's crazy. That means the company's making money. That might help the stock market, but it won't help the cost of housing, which will be in a bubble because it doesn't require the labor force anymore. And yeah, no, the housing is going to get lower in those areas. We've seen this before. This is like in Detroit or manufacturing hubs when the manufacturing went overseas and there's no manufacturing jobs. So people leave. We saw this 100 years ago in, say, mineral rich states like Montana, where the cities, the old cities from the early 1900s were much larger than the cities that we have today, because when mining dried up, the cities went to like a quarter of their size, and people live in these really large houses that they can't afford to upkeep and they don't really need. They're cheap rent districts in that way.
Yeah. Like, have you seen some of the economics in Japan?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So Japan's going through a demographic collapse, right? And they've had a much more stable financial situation because they basically hit their wall on their debt stuff, right? They got to where they had so much debt that they couldn't really manage it anymore. Mm. And so it was not something that they wanted to go through a big wave of bankruptcies and foreclosures and stuff. So instead they kind of moved to a model of just saying, yeah, we've got a lot of big stuff with a lot of debt on it, and we're just going to slowly pay it off over time, over a period of decades, right?
Is it working?
Well, this is the thing, is like one of the things I've been thinking about is like how, like, all economics is just applied politics. Right? And so what do you value? Like, I saw an interview where there was a woman and she was a barista and she was making $1,000 a month living in Japan, and her studio apartment was like $300 a month, but her healthcare was taken care of because it was national healthcare. So she had $700 a month, and her food and everything was, she could more than eat because the costs of things were so much cheaper.
Maslow's.
Like, I've had friends that have gone to Japan recently and they're like, oh my gosh, everything's so cheap now. You're like,
oh wow. Okay.
And so you get to this question that's sort of this subjective thing of like, well, what's this supposed to look like? Right? Like, I'm in Kirkland right now, which is an expensive town. It's Kirkland and Seattle and all that are pretty expensive. Mm-hmm. Let's just say that the average tech salary around here went from, I'm picking a figure, 180 down to 90.
Mm, right? Right.
So it's still quite a bit higher than the average salary. Right.
Right.
But it's, you can't sustain an average house price of, you know, 1.2 million or whatever
right.
off of that salary.
Right.
So then does the price of housing become more affordable? Well, if you're somebody who's about to retire and you have a lot of equity in your house and you're counting on that being important for retirement, then you're going to be like, this is terrible.
Right.
But if you're like a young person who's like trying to get in and buy their first home, you're going to be like, hey, the hot prices of housing drop is awesome.
Sure.
And so what is the tension between what the jobs are supposed to look like and the cost? That's where it's like there's almost this presumption of what it's, quote, supposed to look like.
Ace is an agile consultant who shares space with a coffee shop in order to save on the rent. Meet this hard-boiled, agile consultant and follow his adventures on helping his clients become agile no matter the circumstance. Scrum Noir, the project management comic book that teaches you agile, is available on Amazon. Just search for Scrum Noir, N-O-I-R. We've got more value in the show notes, which have useful links that we discussed or are related to this topic. What are show notes? Show notes show up right in your podcast player for your easy access. If you don't use a podcast player and you downloaded this MP3, go back to the website where you got it and you will see the show notes there. This series started at episode 309. If you're like my friend Boris and you missed the first episode or any of the intervening episodes, go to agilethoughts.info and there you'll find a search box where you can type in the episode number and it will find it for you in a jiffy. Next episode, more Will Iverson.
There was some data, and this is definitely like back to the IT job stuff specifically. I saw that there was this thing about there's a trimodal distribution of salaries for tech. There's basically a huge clump of people that get paid around 80 to 90K a year. There's another clump at around 200K, like 180 to 210. And then there's another clump that's like 400K plus.